In a world with custom calls, custom shotguns, and custom shotgun shells, why stop there? Why not custom decoy rigs made to hunt the way you hunt? From the jerk cords for the flooded timbers of Arkansas, to the long line for the diver hunts of the Great Lakes, to the Texas rigs for the crawfish ponds of Louisiana and the rice fields of the Sacramento Valley. At A-Bear's Custom Decoy Rigs, LLC, they have the rig for you. From their coated cable to their patent tangle-free monofilament rigs to their endless weight, shapes, and sizes, they have what you're looking for. Find them at www.abearcustomdecoyrigs.com or find them on their Facebook page. Remember, get the rig for the way you hunt. Everybody, to another show of Flyweight Connections. Again, I'm here with my buddy Joe and Sharp. Sharp, you want to introduce our guest?
So today on the podcast, we have a friend of mine, Alex Rollo. Pretty funny story about how him and I met up. Kind of meeting someone through social media and kind of talking about similar interests and meeting up and getting to hunting. What's going on, Alex?
Well, gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be on this podcast. To be honest with you, I am a podcast listener myself, but never really thought I'd be on a podcast live. So it's a pleasure. It's an honor to be here tonight, fellas.
Definitely an honor to have us being your first one.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Same thing for me with Flyweight Connections. I was always like an avid podcast listener, and then these guys asked me to hop on. Here we are. So, how was your turkey season? I kind of want to get into turkey season a little bit. I know we're a duck hunting podcast.
Gross.
All bird crazy.
All right. So who's starting the...
You're the guest. You start with the...
Yeah, go ahead. Start us off.
My turkey season is bird watching.
So I'm originally from Georgia, so most of my spring was spent here. But however, I spent about 3 days in Mississippi, just across the Alabama border, going towards Starkville, where University of or Mississippi State, wherever college that is. I can't even remember now. Anyways, so I started out there with a family friend of ours, hunting out there on private land for 3 days. And then I came back, and in the last couple of years, Georgia's season got delayed 2 weeks. And that's a long story for another day. But originally our season would have been the last part of March, but now it started on April 1st this year. So how it worked here is private land opened up first, and then a week later you can hunt public land. And I had a little bit of time to hunt at my deer lease about 2 hours from where I live. Once or twice. And then once the public land opened up, so WMAs, National Forest, Core Land, you know, all that other stuff, that's where I spent most of my time. And I'm gonna be real with you guys. I've only been turkey hunting consecutively now for about 10 years. I got a late start with turkey hunting. I didn't start until I was about 18, and I'm 27 now. So this coming spring will be about 10 years. So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have some really good mentors and been very successful. Most of my harvest have been on public land. But I'll be honest with you, this spring was just goofy. The weather was just off. Things were budding early. We had cold snaps, just endless downpours of rain. And there were a lot of places this year where I've spent a lot of time, especially up in the mountains, because I'm really close to the mountains, and where you would hear one or two turkeys or more, like multiple turkeys gobble in one setting, you just didn't hear that. Or if you just heard one, that would be the only one you'd hear for miles. So, and needless to say, I had a pretty rough spring, and we can go into that in a little bit, but I did end up killing my bird with Mr. Sharp that's in this podcast. So that's a story I'm sure that we brought up here in a little bit, but, it was rough, but I will say it ended on a good note. I definitely ran myself into the ground, so to speak. Most of all my days off, I was in the woods, you know, getting up at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., you know, trying to beat people to the gate, you know, like just you would duck hunt, I guess. And definitely a lot of challenges. One morning I had a misfire. One morning I struck one at 9 o'clock and crawled up to him and thought he was all by himself and got to where I needed to be. And I yelped one time and here come both his hens, and they smelled the rat. And so did he. So that was the end of that one. And chased another bird that ended up getting killed a couple days later. So it was just a if it went wrong, it went wrong. But finally on May 4th, it finally connected. And I just told myself I want off public land because we're allowed two per season, but only off one off public land. And that's what I wanted. And I ended my season on that note. But the rest of it was rough. I mean, I had a lot of big servings of humble soup.
So as far as like your season, I know you kind of talked about, and we'll get more in depth on you saying your rough start and stuff. Just because it kind of popped in my head, out of curiosity, what are you shooting? And then what kind of shells were you shooting for the turkey? And you were using, you know, as far as like your shotgun setup.
I was shooting a Benelli Super Black Eagle 2. So obviously that's a 3.5-inch chambered auto. Most of my birds have been killed with Longbeard XRs from Winchester 3.5-inch number fives. But one that I ended up killing was actually with a 3-inch shell because my gun actually misfired with a 3.5. And yes, it is a 3.5-inch chamber. And I don't know if it was a bad shell. It wasn't wet. I don't know. All I can tell you is when I ejected it, you could see where my primer, you know, was hit by the firing pin. So I don't know. But setup wise, again, the Super Eagle 2, I shoot a Indian Creek. And like I said, I'm one of those people, like if I know it works, I'm not going to change it. And I know TSS is a very popular shell right now. One, I can't afford it. So I just stick to what I know I'm comfortable with. And I don't want to have to pattern that shell because, as you know, just shooting a shotgun, if you shoot a new shell, you're going to want to see what it does on paper. Well, why change it up if I know this is going to work? And, you know, I'm not trying to poke them at 80 yards with it. I'm trying to get them in closer than that. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess I'll go next. This turkey season was absolutely crazy for me. I mean, unreal. Doubled up opening morning with a buddy. Then went back out to another part of that farm that Sunday afternoon, and I shot a quadruple beard. Shortest beard was 8.5. Longest beard was 11. It was a heck of a season up here. I mean, it was too daggum short. I had a bunch of tracts of public land I was going to hunt in North Carolina, but I didn't even have time. So I tagged out on private. Then I kind of got the itch. So I decided, Alex and I were talking. I think I texted you, right? I texted you and I asked if you, I got on Onyx and did a little scouting. I asked him if he hunted this one area close to my girlfriend's house in Murphy, North Carolina. I kind of looked up some public land around there and made a little, him and I kind of got talking and we met up and let's get into it, dude. This is a heck of a story. This is a heck of a story.
So do you want me to tell it, or you want to tell it?
You go ahead and start us off, and I'll chime in here and there.
So it was the first week of May. It was May 4th. And the night before, I did not sleep because, one, you know, anytime you go hunt with someone new you haven't hunted with, you know, you want to be on time. This is a new area. And this was the farthest north I've ever hunted in Georgia. I mean, we were so close to the border. Like, you looked one way, like where we met up at, you looked at one side of the road, it's Georgia. You looked on the other side of the road, it's North Carolina. And I mean, we were way up in elevation. So obviously we were in the mountains. So I meet up with Sharp, and we had a game plan going the night before. And so we go to this first spot, and it was just a road, and it dropped down to a big bowl. I mean, it was really, really steep and got up high. The game plan was to start up high and listen. If we heard a turkey gobble on the roost, we just, you know, go straight to him and just take our time. So we get there, and it's a beautiful morning. It was actually 30 degrees that morning. I mean, it was really, really cold for May. And usually by now it's like how it is here in the 80s and you're sweating to death, but we had one more little cold snap. And I don't know if that helped us or not, but it definitely didn't hurt us. So we get to where we need to be on this roadbed, and lights start coming on and birds start chirping and stuff. And I'm not sure what I heard across the way, but it literally sounded like a helicopter pad, because you can hear something going on, and it sounded like the blades of a helicopter just constantly spinning. And I don't know if it was a construction site. I don't know if it was someone launching a bird. I don't know. Needless to say, we didn't hear anything there. There was obviously some sign of people being there, turkey tracks, and
definitely a turkey got whacked of that on that little track. Yeah. You can see tire tracks and like, you know, all like when you drop a turkey down, you'll see a few of those feathers fall out. It was just all on the road right there. I was like, well, someone definitely smoked one here.
And then down the way, on Onyx, it was all public land. Like the way that the boundary said it was public land. So we start going down this road, and then one side of the road was private. So obviously that was off limits, but then we get a little closer and we see a sign that says property of Humane Society. Now, I've never seen this before, and we tried to do some calling around and see, you know, what the deal was, but on Onyx, it said it was still public land and it was owned by so-and-so and so-and-so and, you know, public land wise. And so Sharp and I just looked at her and said, all right, we need to back out of here before we get caught in a bad mess. So we go down the road and we go onto this another track of public land. Now this time it's a huge ridge system and it's surrounded by cow pastures. This is probably something we're going to see a turkey in. And sure enough, we're going down this gravel road. There's a cow pasture and on the backside of it's all public. So we're going down the road and it's a bottom and it starts to go up in elevation. I mean, it's a steep field. I mean, it goes way up and goes back down again. So we go to this first rise and well, we can see it from the road. And sure enough, there's turkey sitting right there. And we couldn't tell what they were because one, they were just so far off. And by the time we saw them, they just kind of just went on the backside of the hill. So we keep going down and something catches my eye. I said, stop. And I look over and I was using Sharp's binoculars and I look and it was a longbeard just all by himself. And so we keep going down farther road. There's a gate right there that goes into public land. So we get out of the truck, put our stuff on. Now from where our truck was parked at, from this bird, I mean, this was easily, what do you think, about 250, 300 yards from when we first saw him when he was in that field?
Going up the hill, I'd say at least three, because like where the gate was and then where you could walk on the public, you could get closer to him.
So we park and get our stuff on and all that. And we make our way into the woods. And I went ahead and told Sharp, I said, I'm going to try to strike him real quick. So I just put in my mouth call and, you know, started cutting and yelping and getting real aggressive with him. And he didn't answer right away. But then a crow flies over him. Danny fires off. So now we know he's still in the field and he keeps going and he keeps going and he keeps going. And I'm agging him on and keeping him going stuff. So this was going on for about 10 minutes or so. And then we start making our way around because again, this was a huge ridge system. When we walked this ridge system for a couple hours, and according to his Onyx track, because it's got that little tracker where it'll tell you how far you've walked and stuff, 10 miles back and forth. I mean, just constant walk.
So we didn't get to this new spot till probably what, 8:45?
Probably about 8:30.
8:30. And then the first gobble we got was about at 9 o'clock, a little after 8:39, somewhere in between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, somewhere in there.
And typically during that time frame, and Chris and Joe, I don't know how much you guys have turkey hunted, but you know, if you can get a turkey to gobble between 9 and 2, a lot of times he's by himself and his hens have left him to go late. And if you get him to answer you, he's coming. Well, that wasn't necessarily the case. So he goes quiet. And then I call again and I'm getting like really aggressive. I mean, I'm cutting, I'm yelping, I'm just getting loud. And then I hear a hen yelping. I mean, I'm like, that's why I cut it up. So then me and Sharp spent the rest of the morning. We literally walked around this whole ridge system until we couldn't get any closer to the boundary. And me and Sharp were kind of sitting there. It's like, we kind of sit there and ponder ourselves like, man, why do we walk all this way? And I kind of looked at him and said, we should probably walk back to where we struck him that. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so we make our way back. And, you know, and in between, he's got his trumpet call and I've got a mouth call in. And so finally we go down to initial where we struck him. So mind you, this is no more than, what do you think, Sharp, about 150 yards from where we parked at, where we first struck him at?
No, that trail that went up there was a straight line, yes, but on the trail, I think further. Like if you did like a straight line distance, probably that, but like the way the trail went through there is probably right. A little longer.
So by this point, it's about 11 o'clock. And so we're making our way back down. And I just looked at him and said, he looked at me and said, you want to try to yelp at him again? I said, yeah. So through my mouth call in, you know, made a few notes, cut it at him, yelped, and he cussed me off mid-sequence. Well, before that, I thought I heard him, and I just couldn't tell, and that happens so much. Like, you'll be like, did he just gobble? And then you do it again, and he does. So finally, that second time, he answers, I mean, and he sounds a lot closer than he did before. So we sit down right there, because I'm thinking, okay, he's going to come running looking for us. He's by himself. I mean, it's going to get Western here. Well, come to find out, that was the last time he gobbled. So Sharp wanted to see where this bird was still at, because we couldn't really tell if he was on public or private. I mean, he was closer, but the way that this land laid, you know, that sound will bounce off those hills and those big hollers and those big ridge tops and stuff. So we didn't know. So Sharp actually goes back down into his truck just to kind of get eyes on where this bird was. And there was two other turkeys there, but I don't know if it was him that he saw or was it?
I don't know, because I think another bird jumped up with him. Cause so like he said in the beginning of the story, there's two patches of turkeys, and the one longbeard we saw by himself was closer to us on the, where we could access the land. So I thought, you know, we heard him gobble and he kind of stopped. I know he was hung up in that field. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to go get eyes on him to go see where he was at, to see kind of how we could approach him. And the way it worked is like the field edge was not the boundary line. The boundary line went up into the woods a little bit. So like that was hurting us, because we couldn't get right on the field edge. We had to stay up in the woods because the way the property line worked. So, but when we heard him gobble, it kind of sounded like he was walking away up towards the ridge that we walked. And like this ridge, guys, would you say it was probably the most beautiful hardwood ridge you've seen? I mean, it was.
Oh yeah.
You could see for a long, if you put a deer stand up there, you could easily take a 200 yard shot in the woods. I mean, that's saying something in the woods in Georgia.
Oh yeah. And it was just one of those places where we just looked at each other and said, man, if this was a place you could kill a turkey, it came up, you know, it got steep and it got to a big roadbed and it was real flat and just beautiful. Well, come to find out later on in the story, that's where this turkey ended up, history. So finally, Sharp comes back to where I'm still sitting at, and we go back to just from where we just came from and this pretty ridge that we were just talking about. So we sit down and he's on one tree, I'm on the other, and we're kind of watching, you know, this ridge top. Anytime, especially Easterns, and I don't know where you guys are from, but Easterns, you know, they, especially Southeast, it's always a good idea to get above them, because they don't like to walk down the hill because they can't turn around and fly off, but at least when they're walking up a hill, they can escape. So we got above him. I mean, as close as we probably could within line with him. So we sit down for about an hour or so, and the wind starts picking up, and you know, just, I mean, it's not bad to the point where you can't hear anything, and you know, it's just kicking, but I mean, it's getting breezy. And so we do a sequence of calling and stuff like that. I had my mouth calling. Sharp had a glass slate and his trumpet. I
was scratching too, because it was all those leaves. So we'd sit there and like, we'd do a call sequence and we'd try to act like two hens firing off, and like kind of play off of him. And then I'd kind of scratch some leaves here and there.
Mm-hmm. And so about an hour, 15 rolls by, and it's getting about 12 ish. Sharp had other plans after that. And we're kind of getting towards that timeline where we were about to leave.
I got on the phone too. My dad, like literally, my dad just called me. I talked to my dad for like 2 minutes. I'm like, hey, I'm hunting. I got to hang up. I hang up.
And so about that time, so mind you, we're still sitting down at the base of these trees. And so usually my gun's on my knees, ready to go. So now it's in my lap. And Sharp had made this comment. He goes, you know, the most of my luck has had where my gun's in my lap. I'm like, oh, okay. Because at this point, you know, I've had my butt handed to me, and just, you know, anything that could happen did happen. You know, I was like, all right, why not? So, you know, I put my gun in my lap and we're sitting there and I hear Sharp go, don't move. Do not move. And I thought he was BSing me for a minute. I'm like, what? And mind you, I'm half asleep. I'm thinking, you know, I'm not quite awake. I mean, I've been up for most of the night and I hear, don't move. Do not move. Do not move. I'm like, what? He goes, 70 yards, come right down the road. I was like, okay, what is it? He goes, it's a longbeard. All right. And so he's zigzagging back and forth. And this bird had this little fast pace. He was looking for those hens that he could not see. So he was high, you know, doing the, you know, kind of like a goose when he's looking for the whole flock. I mean, he's doing this. I mean, he's zigzagging through the woods and stuff like that. And I looked at Sharp and I said, okay, just tell me when I can put my gun up. So mind you, my gun's still in my lap. Like I can't move. So finally he looks at me and goes, okay, now. So now I'm right-handed. So now I'm sitting like this. And I mean, I don't have a rest. I mean, technically speaking, I'm shooting free-handed. He comes through one little opening and I just didn't feel okay with it. And so finally I had one more opening and I looked and I said, here he comes. You ready? He goes, yeah, go ahead and kill him. So finally he gets in that opening. I fired once and he rolls back and I knew I hit him and he was probably 50 yards again. That's probably my max. But at this point I was just going to just send it. Like I was just like, all right, whatever. So he rolls back and he takes flight. Now, mind you, I didn't hear him coming. I didn't hear him walking. He didn't gobble. He didn't spit, drum, nothing. I mean, he came in unannounced. So he takes flight and I get back on him again and I literally shoot this gobbler out of the air like if it was a goose. I mean, put it right underneath him and just rolled him. And unfortunately, and you guys can probably go look at the picture, he didn't have the most graceful landing as they're supposed to flop. He hit a few branches on the way down and a deadfall. And unfortunately, he lost some of his feathers, but we recovered him and I got some of his feathers now. So, and needless to say, that was a quite the celebration. And that whole experience, like this is the first time me and Sharper really hunted together because we actually hunted not too far from each other in Arkansas and ran the other day when he was guiding stuff and I was duck hunting with my dad. And so, you know, that was one thing. But also, like, I mean, it felt like it was the first turkey I ever killed. And I just remember saying, I did it. It was awesome. And then, you know, and just the rest was history. And I had to shoot him twice like that, but just the way it goes. But, you know, that's really it. And, you know, and Sharp will tell you, too. I mean, we basically went in this place blind. I'd never been on this track of public land and neither he. And that was the most craziest part. We just went off with a map showed us on Onyx. And I heard a saying one time from a guy, good woodsmanship kills more turkeys than there. And
I mean, it was a scout. We just looked at, there's certain things you got to look at that you can find where birds hang out at. And we put those, our two cents together. And I mean, the first spot we went to, God, I thought it was a good looking spot. Like I kind of want to talk about that a little bit more. Yep. I've never seen that sign before on national forest land. So like we go down a national forest road. It is tagged national forest road on there. Like it shows it on Onyx. You got the purple line going down it, right? That's means a ATV or car trail.
Yeah.
So we go down that and we park, and, you know, and like he said, we get up to the high spot of the bowl and we kind of park a little bit. We don't go all the way up to the ridge. We kind of stop a little bit because when we were looking, there were some pines and we didn't want to get, we kind of wanted to start right at the top of the pines and then work our way down. So we started calling there, but then we wanted to kind of go loop around to the other side of it. And as we were walking up that gravel road, we get to go and like, there is a trailhead, just a normal walking trailhead sign, National Forest sign right there that goes to the left. And then on the right side of it, it says no hunting, no trapping, no trespassing, Humane Society on National Forest land. There is no mark from any government agency on there, like no DNR, no National Forest stuff. So I see those signs. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to stop. I'm not getting in trouble over nothing. Like I told you, could ask Alex. I was like, bro, I ain't even stepping on that trailhead. I ain't getting off this gravel road. Like we're going back this way. So, but
I was in the same boat too, because I mean, you can build, you know, houses and stuff on national forest land, but however, you got to have special permits. And because again, it's not owned by the state, it's owned by the U.S. Forest Service. So, I mean, that's probably a whole different animal, but still, that was the first time I've ever seen anything like that. And I thought I was seeing stuff, but I was like, what? You know, because on Onyx, it wasn't owned by the Humane Society. It was owned by the forest.
No, yeah, it says national, like on the Onyx, it says national forest. And like, I tried calling local game warden. I left him a message. They never called me back.
I figured they didn't.
Yeah. I was just interested to see like what it was, you know, I like all down for it. But I mean, if it's going to, like, my buddy told me sometimes they'll have that up here in North Carolina. And what they'll do is they'll put in bird nesting sites. So like this time of the year, they don't want people going into there. So they'll put up those signs in the bird nesting sites for like grouse and turkeys, which that makes sense a little bit. But he said every time that happened up here, there was like a state biologist. There was something saying that the state or the federal government was a part of it.
Well, usually in North Carolina, like when I was in North Carolina, when I lived there, it was called for the grouse and the bobwhite, it was called Cure Land. Yeah, it's good conservation for upland bird restoration environment. I know in North Carolina, that's what they would do. And it was called Cure Land. And there was like certain times of the year you couldn't hunt the cure.
And y'all were hunting in Georgia, right?
Yeah, this was North Georgia.
I mean, probably some local boys messing with y'all, so you ain't hunting there.
You know, Ace, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, no, I'm just joking. But what were you gonna say, Sharp? Or you just
nothing. Wreck it, Ralph, in it. This is mountain internet. It's no good.
But he was to say that was a very day. I mean, it just like with any other hunting out there, it things can change in a heartbeat. And you know, after, in nicer terms, getting my butt handed me, I was just kind of expecting, man, this is gonna, you know, be another, you know, one of those days and all that stuff. And just I guess it was just my time, you know, to finally make it happen. And so, and if you keep staying persistent at it, it'll happen. And you know, It was just one of those things. And that was actually the latest in the season and in the day I've ever killed a turkey. Most of my turkeys have been killed right off the rip, or, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock. This bird was killed at 12:15 on the dot at May 4th. And usually most of my birds have been killed in April. I've never killed one that late. So it can happen anytime. So,
yeah. So I guess because like we said earlier, but we are a waterfowl podcast, but I mean, we all do different game type of hunting. We all fish. I mean, everybody here does different stuff. So, but and we do get listeners that try to transition into different styles of hunting. Yeah. I guess for the new listeners, kind of give a description of like what the perfect turkey, I guess, scenario. And I mean, cause we've talked about the perfect different species of duck, or even what ducks are looking for. What is the perfect scenario for a turkey, and what are they typically looking for?
That's a dependable state by state.
Okay.
That depends.
Okay. So we'll go by region. Okay.
Let's go with our Eastern birds. I mean, that even changes from the mountain.
Yeah. We'll feel like your Eastern birds are a lot different than my Eastern birds.
Yeah.
Now, where
you I guess let's simplify it. I mean, we'll go just in Georgia where y'all are at. Okay. We all understand that. I mean, just like anything, whether you're fishing, you can kind of match the hatch. What are they looking for? What are they, you know, what kind of food source are they looking for? Is there a water source, et cetera? So I guess we'll just kind of go off of what Georgia. And then we have a special guest as well on too. Good old future next generation hunter.
Oh, yeah. It's
Joe's boy.
Oh, Bo Spears is first.
So we always, I mean, we love it. It's the next generation. Of hunters, so that's amazing. But anyways, yeah, man, go ahead and I mean, if you can kind of talk that through, just so like your listeners, let's say in your area in Georgia, just like, hey, I just moved to Georgia. You know, we get there's a lot of military bases in Georgia, right? A lot of hunters from different areas. So just kind of give that description, so like different, I guess you'd say service members or veterans that move down there can kind of like, oh man, you know, it's different hunting here.
So Georgia is. Georgia's been a state that's been a hot topic for the last 3 years during COVID and afterwards, because during that time frame, a lot of people were turkey hunting because it was in the spring. So the population is still on the decline. However, the state is trying to do things to revive that population it once was. But so this state is different, I would say. Now, most of my time has been spent in North Georgia, because where I live about an hour north of Atlanta, on Lake Lanier, essentially. So I'm really close to the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Appalachian Trail. I can be, you know, in the foothills and the mountains about 40 or 50 minutes or so. So most of my time is spent up there. You have a lot of WMAs and there's a lot of national forest land. And you know, certain areas outside of that, you can hunt Corps of Engineers land. There's several public land opportunities. And yes, that is correct. You can hunt certain military bases. Now, I don't know much about that. I knew Fort Stewart was one of them down in Savannah on the coast. I think Benning's one of them too. Again, I don't know. I'd had to ask my dad about that one because he's a vet. So
unfortunately, it's Fort Moore now.
What's that?
It's no longer Fort Benning. Changed the name.
Right. Yeah. But
it's still Benning.
It's still Benning at heart.
Yeah.
I'm not a vet, so I wouldn't know. But anyways, but so these birds here in the southeast, and a lot of your avid turkey hunters will probably tell you this. Now, again, Sharp and I, you know, we're kind of the same boat. I mean, we're not, you know, your Dave Owens or Harold Knight or Will Primo's turkey hunters. But I mean, we've spent some time in the woods and stuff like that. But anyone that's ever hunted in this region of the country will tell you these are probably some of the hardest eastern turkeys you will ever have to deal with, because number one, they're very sensitive to the weather around them. Number two, they use the terrain to their advantage because you have a lot of rolling hills, a lot of saddles, a lot of big ridge tops. And yes, Georgia does have mountains. The beginning of the Appalachian Trail starts here for the most part. And, you know, you have big hardwood bottoms, big pine ridges. I mean, just very diverse terrain stuff. But any turkey hunter that's ever been here will tell you, if you can kill one here, you can kill one just about anywhere. Weather-wise, you know, it just depends on the bird, because you know, they're not like waterfowl where they can somewhat read the script and they're almost textbook. These turkeys are probably the most unpredictable birds, and Sharp could probably agree with you this here. They when you think you have it them figured out, you don't. And so any day where the wind's not blowing, it's not disgusting out. You have a high barometer pressure because the barometer actually affects their hormones to the point where it makes them more vocal. No wind, sunshine, high pressure day. But again, I mean, I know guys have killed them, you know, when it's a monsoon out. I know guys have killed them when it's sleeting out, or, you know, the wind's blowing 40 miles an hour. So it just depends on the bird, because I mean, if you find a bird that's wanting to play the game rather, you know, that's ready to, you know, play ball with you and come running down your gun barrel. I mean, it just, you know, you can kill them in any weather, but it just, like I said, it just depends on how pressure the bird is, how, you know, willing that bird is, because the hardest thing about turkey hunting is you're trying to get him to do something that he's not intended to do, which is leave his hens, because it's not, the hen goes to the gobbler. It's not the other way around. And, you know, obviously like with ducks, you know, you're trying to bring them to you or what have you. But in reality with turkey hunting, you're going to him, because it's like, hey, I'm here, you can come find me, but I'm not coming to you. And so that's why you have to get so close to them, you know, pop their bubble basically and cut the distance, because I mean, unless he's ready to just like just meet his maker and just come running down your gun barrel, I mean, they ain't gonna budge. They're that stubborn. And again, they're very sensitive to their surroundings, and anything can just shut them up, whether it be the wind or a coyote or another hunter bumps them and stuff. And that's another thing too. This state has really, in the last couple of years, has seen a lot of hunting pressure. I mean, even on the place I've hunted at, I mean, I've seen more people these last couple of years than I've ever had before. And it's like, you know, it's rough terrain, but you know, just like with any public land, nothing's a secret anymore. And if it's really easy to access, you're not the only one that knows about it.
Hey, Sharp, you're on mute, buddy.
Yeah. I was about to say,
let's talk about that daggum laurel thicket we had to run up. So, like, when I went to go look at that bird. I had to run out down the trail, hop in my truck, drive down the gravel road, hop on my binoculars and see where he was in the field. And I was like, there's two long beards. Oh, I was so excited when I called him. I was like, get ready. So I start like sprinting up to him, and him and I have to go run up this laurel thicket, dude. Like you said, it's crazy. Like you'll just be going like the North Georgia mountains. You'll be going, then you'll hit a laurel, like a mountain laurel thicket or a rhododendron thicket. And then you're just in like the most open hardwood bottom. Or a hardwood ridge you've ever seen.
And that's why a lot of people don't hunt it. It's because the trail. There's some places it's like Mount Everest steep. I mean, it is no joke. I mean, it's not muck poop country. Like, you got to have some like good lace ups, you know, and you definitely got to have your cardio where it needs to be.
Hey, Alex.
Sir.
Mr. John Perez just said hi to you right now.
Oh, tell him I say hey back. I know John Perez very well. Ben, his son, and I used to call against each other. Good people.
Yeah, that's like, John's like my older brother I never had.
Yeah, they're good folks.
So you kind of brought it up, and before we transition over to the call world and waterfowl, okay. Sharp or Joe, did y'all have anything more on the? Sharp, do you have anything more on turkey season?
I'm not gonna do it to Joe anymore. I know it's killing him. What's
my turkey season, I've probably seen more turkey than I ever had this year. Our Easterns down. So I grew up in California with the Rios.
Right.
Those birds are the easiest thing to kill.
Really?
Rios are just they're just easy. I mean, they're done. Slam
a car door and they're gobbling.
Yeah, they're gobbling. There's a lot of them.
Tell him what guys on public were doing around there to try to get them to gobble this year.
Oh, well, right now I'm hunting in Louisiana. I retired out of Louisiana. And the big thing about here is running and gunning is different. To interpret differently state by state.
Oh, absolutely.
So running gunning here in Louisiana with our Louisianians, which, you know, are great duck hunters. There's some good turkey hunters. Like Mr. Bill Daniels, awesome turkey hunter. But here you can drive around and it's honk your horn. And if a turkey gobbles, then it's all right. If not, you drive to the next low water crossing or something on public land, mm-hmm. You honk your horn. If you don't hear nothing, go somewhere else. And yeah, it's just, you know, turkey hunting down here is very, very slim picking. But Successful year for me this year was, I mean, there was one day, I think I've seen 8 toms.
Holy cow.
Yeah, easily. 8 toms. And everything I had, you know, because I kind of have a rule where I don't shoot past 40 yards. Mm-hmm. It's just, even when I'm shooting a Pattern Master, I'll shoot some TSS. I just don't like it.
Right.
There's too many variables.
Mm-hmm.
Where you guys hunt, in like North Carolina, where I hunted with, you know, John Perez and Ben a lot, you know, it's open fields. Any tilled field you see in North Carolina, rather, you know, you're going to see a turkey in the spring strutting around.
Yeah.
I mean, my oldest boy, John, Joey, he killed his first turkey with John. His first 2 turkeys he killed with John. And his first duck he killed with John.
How about that?
Yeah. Small world, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you come down here and you're not going to see turkeys in the open like that. They're going to be down deep in the swamp. You're going to see them in real marshy, nasty. When you look at something, you're like, I bet you that place is infested with moccasins. That's where the turkey is going to be.
Really? That's
either that or the running roads.
Yeah, I could see that.
I mean, so it sounds like they're almost like a mountain bird, you know? Because like,
yeah.
Because you've hunted down kind of like south, middle Georgia, where you're hunting more like pines, mature pines and stuff like that. Those birds are completely different than the mountain birds. They act completely different.
Oh yeah. The birds down in South Georgia, when you start getting on flat terrain, they kind of act a little better. And the farthest south I've ever hunted in Georgia was actually down towards Brunswick on some public land. And I mean, I'm looking at freaking palm trees and big Spanish moss trees and palmettos. And I'm walking in, on sandy roads. And I mean, you look in some of the water, I mean, some of it's brackish. And I mean, probably some of it was gator infested at one point. I'm surprised I didn't see one, but no, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's night and day from running those hills to taking a walk on the beach, basically down there. So
yeah, so it's, I guess, go ahead.
It's Sorry. Definitely different. It's you know, you go from really steep terrain to flat, and I mean, and there's no such thing as a hill down there, you know. So definitely, it's kind of probably like what Joe's hunting down there in Louisiana.
Yeah.
So, and before we go into like the call-in world and then stuff like that, Georgia has one season or two seasons for turkey?
Just one. This one year, April 1st to May 15th. And if I do my math correctly, it was only 45 days long. So. Okay.
We're not going to harp on your math too much. You're from Georgia, man. You're good. I'm just kidding. Hey, man. I'm joking. But,
okay.
All right. So I know we talked about, you know, good buddy of Joe's in the call world. And I know Shark brought it up earlier. And Joe, like you said before we got on, he's definitely a call nut. And then Sharp as well. They've done some things in the call world and then call collecting. I think Sharp and Joe were talking about earlier. Then
that's all I've done.
Yeah,
get some. I'm not a call collector. I have some calls.
Yeah, all right. Anyways, we're not going to get into that.
You fall in the contest.
I am not an alcoholic. Like, that's Joe. I am not a call collector. Like, yeah, all right, but let me see how many calls you got. Let me see all your lanyards. But anyways, how many lanyards? Never mind. But anyways, talk about a little bit about your calling experience and then the competitions you got into. And then I know this will be a big one for the other guys and stuff, as far as the call world, I just go pay to watch the show.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about, you know, me just, you know,
Chris,
anyway, just say to the whistle and the jerk string, and I'll be okay. But
yeah. I finally figured out the lighting situation. So if it's been dark the whole time, you guys can see it. My bad.
You're good.
So no,
you just like to look mysterious like that.
That's how I build things. Anyways. So I grew up waterfowl hunting. My father got me into it when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And some of my earliest memories were on these bigger reservoirs we got here in Georgia, hunting with him and shooting a couple mallards here and stuff like that and geese. And so, as you might know, and Sharp can agree with this, Georgia is not on the map for waterfowl hunting. That is a very foreign thing. You know, you may run into especially some
area like that area north of right around Atlanta.
Yeah.
Thing, like just reservoirs.
Yeah. Well, you know, you may run some wood ducks here, and we're infested with the resident Canada geese, and you may run into some divers and some park mallards basically. But anyway, so, I actually started blowing a duck call when I was about 4 years old. Just, you know, my dad had, you know, an old Jansen duck call one day, and, you know, I started playing with that and started watching, you know, Will Primos with the Mastering the Art Guide to Calling Ducks and stuff like that, and watching the old school Whistling Wings and some of the older waterfowl hunting videos and stuff like that. And so I started blowing a duck call at a really early age. And then I had a family friend that used to make custom calls and making me more. And he gave me one, and he's saying, "Hey dude, you know, you blow a call decently. Why don't you get in the contest call?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't know anything about it." So, because again, Georgia's not on the radar still for contest calling or anything like that. So I actually blew in my first duck calling contest when I was 15. It was the Georgia State Meat Duck. And that was when they had that, the 2-man meat duck, in the state that punched your ticket for Stuttgart. And I placed okay in it, but nothing really came out of it. And I started chasing it more and more and started, you know, going to these calling contests. And I won my first novice meat duck contest when I was 16 up in Kentucky. And then walked, had a few more placements, you know, in Illinois and some other places. But when I was 17, I actually won the Georgia State Duck Calling Contest, and I was the youngest to ever win the Georgia State Duck Calling Contest and to qualify for Stuttgart, which is the world championship duck calling contest they have every year. And then I got into goose calling. I killed a lot of geese growing up. So I became very, very familiar with a Canada goose's vocabulary, and I started watching videos and stuff, and didn't really have anyone to show me that part. A lot of the things I learned was just auditory. I can hear the note and I can just mimic it. But when I got into contest calling, when I started, you know, going more contests, I got involved with R&T calls when Butch Brickback was alive, and he was actually my mentor. And then once I stepped away from the custom calls that my family friend had, some, we're still friends this day, but, I actually was affiliated with Tim Grounds. I actually blew his goose calls for a long time, and, him and Hunter Grounds, were my mentors, and, you know, I started learning from them and stuff. And I didn't win many goose calling contests, just solely the fact is one, a lot of your goose calling contests are really, really far from where I live at. The only type one was Illinois novice goose up there at Preppies. No, excuse me. It was actually at Foyles' Migrant shop, Jeff Foyles' place. And then I won a smaller goose calling contest up Kentucky, up in Middle Kentucky. I can't remember the name of the town anymore, but so I won those, and I have gone to World Goose before. And this, when I was 17, I blew in the live goose and the World Goose. I didn't make the cut, but you know, I've, you know, got on the stage and did my best stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've, you know, I've been to the big stuff like that, you know. And once I went off to college and stuff, I kind of had to take a step back from it and focus on that, and then adulthood happens. So, but yeah, I mean, I've had a few placements under my belt. You know, like I said, I haven't blown in a contest about 5 years, and you know, so that's really about it. You know, I haven't had a chance to go to one. You know, there's some days I'm like in the back of my head now, I just got other things to worry about. Yeah, but for a while there, I was on a stage with both.
So how was it, Sam? I mean, because you said some pretty big names there. And the duck call, especially the duck call world with Mr. Butch. Mm-hmm. How was it seeing that? I mean, or did you know at the time that just how influential of a guy? And because I, you know, you probably blew an MVP.
Absolutely.
That was tuned by Butch.
Yep, sure was.
It was probably one of his old lips.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and then it was probably a saw cut off a jig.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, now looking back at it, it's like, the viewers and stuff, and the guys you do know, I mean, you know, that's just an amazing time and duck calling, and, you know, and coming up in duck calling was, you know, being set up like that.
I'm so jealous. Like, him and I are talking about this in the Turkey Woods. It's like, I got into it kind of when those guys were phasing out, and I never got to like see that side of it. And I'm very jealous of you for that.
Well, let me tell you something. If you ever had the chance to meet Butch Richenbach, you know, he, just like Tim Grounds, Tim Grounds pioneered the short reed goose call. Butch Richenbach pioneered the duck call. And I will tell you this, and I'm sure the whole world's going to hear this, there will never be another Butch Richenbach, and there will never be another Tim Grounds. And if you had the chance to meet both of them, salty the earth. I mean, they have helped thousands of people. I mean, just some of these big time names at one point, you know, either worked or called for Butch or Tim. And Butch was a one of a kind man. I mean, he would stop what he was doing just to listen to you blow a duck call and give you constructive criticism. But man, he is the reason a lot of folks have qualified for Stuttgart, won Stuttgart, or had championship titles. And the same thing with Tim Grounds. I mean, was called the number one goose man for a reason. Tim Grounds was called the godfather, you know, with, you know, goose calling and stuff. And both of them, I mean, they were something else. And, you know, I didn't get to see them much because, again, you know, they lived hours away from me. But the times I did get to spend with them, I mean, those are memories that last a lifetime. I mean, just both of them. And again, there will never be another of both of them in both arenas.
Yeah. When competing with Goose, what call did you blow?
What's that?
What call did you blow when you're competing in the Goose?
I blew a triple thing.
Yeah.
Triple thing, man, you had it tuned right. Good God, I think you get up and go. So, and then my real thing, when I first started blowing in the intermediates and novice goose calling contest, I blew that for all, but now that's just my hunting calling. I'm going to tell you something that when they named it that, that was very fitting because I mean, that thing has killed a lot of geese.
Yeah. I mean, well, like for viewers, you said, Tim Grounds, if you just look at all the call companies that are out now, and there is tons of great goose callers. You know, I can toy with a speckle belly pretty decently. For some reason, I can't a goose. I am rudimentary at best. But you look at all these, you know, great goose callers and these great call companies now, the lineage all goes back to that man.
Yep. They all start. Grounds. All of them. Fred Zink, Sean Stahl, Scott Trinan. I mean, all of them. I mean, they all started from Tim Grounds.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how that works. But still, I mean, he's still credited as, you know, the number one goose man. I mean, and it still shows. I mean, his calls are still winning stuff. And, you know, even
still killing birds.
Oh, yeah. Even though I don't blow in contests anymore, but just the sentimental fact of it. I mean, that's the only goose call I have around my neck.
Yeah.
As long as I'm doing it. I mean, just one, because who Tim Grounds was, and along with Hunter Grounds and stuff, but just, I mean, they're just that good.
Yeah. I mean, and it's probably Hunter Grounds easily can be the best goose caller alive today.
Oh,
easily.
I think he still is.
Yeah.
Still
And it's funny. You guys both say about Georgia, not being the X on the map for duck hunting, but you have some very, very, very good duck hunters.
Yeah.
That come out of Georgia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There ain't no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Charles.
Mr. Charles.
Yeah. Yeah. Dustin, I mean, you have a lot of guys that it's kind of, you know, you can see why here in Louisiana, in Arkansas.
Right.
In California, where to me, hunting all the flyways, those three states are probably what I consider the top three duck hunting destinations for puddle ducks. And you see a lot of guys out of Georgia, the Carolinas, which, you know, Carolina's probably up there. I really enjoyed my time in North Carolina hunting. Mm-hmm. But you have a lot of guys that come out of Georgia and Alabama that are very good duck hunters and that will chase ducks like no other.
Well, I agree, Chase. We got to chase them because we ain't got them.
Well, and if you look at it on the map, like Georgia's in between the Mississippi Flyway and the Atlantic Flyway, technically. And, you know, you may get some exotic birds here like widgeons or black ducks or, you know, something that's rare. But, I mean, you're just not going to find them here. And, you know, the birds that are here, you know, it's just not – it's not what the rest of y'all are used to seeing or what I'm used to seeing. You know, I mean, yeah, we got resident geese here and they're fun to chase around in September or whatever. But other than that, I mean, there's just one, we don't have the food to push them down or the food to keep them here. And plus, you know, the state really doesn't manage for waterfowl is that, you know, Georgia's known for deer hunting because, I mean, let's be honest here, we can shoot 12 here. So it's kind of where the priorities are at. And it's not waterfowl.
So what states have you chased birds in?
Let's see, here, Tennessee, Kentucky, Illinois, Arkansas, and South Carolina.
You never had a chance to go up North Carolina and hunt a little bit?
No, I've hunted geese in South Carolina and that's, you know, close. I mean, only because it was around the other side of the border in South Carolina in February for 2 weeks. And I'm like, you know, why not? You know, another chance to shoot geese. And it's actually a fun time of year to go shoot resident geese because they're starting to pair up and they're not as, you know, pressured. And a lot of times those smaller flocks are kind of they're a little more easier to fool.
Yeah. Like me and John, I talk to John on a weekly basis. And, you know, John's telling, I don't know the last time he talked to old John Perez, but he works for Mossy Oak and he's worked for Mossy Oak property.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's trying to give me, every time when you're moving back to North Carolina. But he was saying, I wouldn't be surprised if the duck population kind of comes up on the rise in the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. He was saying a lot of those areas are returning. What a lot of people don't know is North Carolina and South Carolina were big rice countries back 30, 40 years ago.
I know that.
It was very,
very, yeah. What they considered the low country.
Low country
was all rice. And now that he's saying a lot of it, because a lot of Louisiana is pulling away from the rice, mm-hmm. and a lot of North Carolina, South Carolina are going back to rice fields. Rice is an agricultural crop.
That'll bring it.
That's crazy. Like just thinking about like the agriculture of rice and stuff. Like, because you look down in Katy, Texas, and South Texas, I mean, it was nothing but rice down there. Down in, mm-hmm. I mean, El Campo and all that. So, I mean, how it's crazy how it makes a shift. I know Louisiana went to what, sugar cane, right?
Yeah, we're starting. We're still probably top three for rice, but a lot of people don't know Katy, Texas crawfish. Used to be, huh?
Is your
crawfish? Yeah, we're going a lot of crawfish.
Yeah, crawfish.
But yeah. Katy, Texas used to be the number. You know, that was
snow goose capital
of the world.
Yeah.
That's where the rags were invented.
Yeah, Texas rag, Texas rigs.
Yep.
And it is. It's weird to see all the agriculture change and how much agriculture and weather plays on these migratory birds.
Yeah, because we have a buddy down in Katy, and he tells us it's not. He doesn't even hunt waterfowl no more. He goes up to Arkansas.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty much teal season out there for them now. They get a teal season around that El Campo area, and like I follow a few guys from around there. You know, there's a few spots that get them here and there, but I mean, it's not.
I mean, you can still you'll still get your species of ducks down there. I mean, that's but I mean, just like the snow, like we're talking about Katy and like how it just changed agriculture and. When I talked to our buddy that lives down there, I've talked to him one-on-one. He's just the development that they've been doing. They rice is not the thing no more there, and now it's just they're just building buildings and houses, and it's just different. So, but he doesn't. Hell, I don't even think. I don't know, Joe. Does he? I don't even know if he hunts waterfowl like he used to. So,
are you talking about old Mr. Pitcher?
Yeah,
yeah. He just guides. I mean, he's guiding up in Jonesboro. For geese, that's his thing.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I thought California was the number one rice producer.
Arkansas, and then it'll bounce from Louisiana, Texas, and California will kind of bounce around.
Okay. Because I know all through the Sac Valley, that's all y'all got.
Yeah, it's all rice.
Even in Northern California, parts of Northern California, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Now we're talking about Cali. You see the refuges are still dry.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to get that. We talked about it on the podcast. You're going to get that with, I mean, I'm heading back home here to go visit family next month. And I'll say it, until you get rid of the California aqueducts, pulling the water off of the north and giving it to rich people in the swimming pools down in the south, you're going to continue to have it. I mean, I don't care how many people get upset about that statement, but I mean, it's just what it is.
Yeah, they're buying that water.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much buying it is, more of taking,
yeah.
So I guess before we kind of get towards the end of the show, I kind of asked you your shotgun setup for when you're hunting turkey. Alex, when you're doing waterfowl, what's your setup there?
So I've actually got two shotguns that I've got. If that counts. So I've got my Benelli I was talking about, and then I got another gun that's really, really special to me. So when I was growing up, some of my earliest memories was with my dad, as I mentioned, and he had a Browning BPS. 3-inch 12 gauge with a 30-inch barrel on it. Now, if you know anything about the Browning BPS, it's one of the only pump shotguns that ejects from the bottom. And it's a very heavy gun, but it's probably one of the best pump shotguns out there. So long story short, I've always wanted a BPS because one of the sentimental value of it, but also it's just a freaking awesome gun. I mean,
yeah, they are a workhorse.
Just
I have with one. I love it.
Just watching my dad shoot birds with it growing up, and just, you know, just all the memories with it, you know. Just, I've always wanted one. I told myself when I graduated college, I was going to buy one, you know, for my graduation gift. Well, I actually graduated college in May of 2020. So I didn't get to have a college graduation because of COVID. But my dad actually handed me down that BPS that day. And needless to say, there was not a dry eye in that room. And I had to walk a second because I squalled, because that gun meant everything to me. I mean, I'd rather have anything else taken away from me. Something happened to that shotgun, I'd be devastated. So, so my other gun besides my Benelli is my Browning BPS. It's a 30-inch barrel, Vector Plus. It's the field model. And so I will shoot a, if that's primarily my goose gun, because one, it's just such a big gun, and it's just such a, it has a longer barrel on it. I mean, I've shot ducks with it before. I've actually shot teal with it in the timber one time. But if I'm hunting somewhere open, you know, or I'm hunting geese, you know, that's kind of like my goose gun. But, shell wise, I like to shoot BBs or number twos, 3-inch, can't go wrong with them. Kents, Winchesters. If it fires and I know it'll kill them, you know, that's about it. But actually, that gun, with it being a 30-inch barrel, I actually just shoot a factory model, Index Plus modified, and I mean, I could hold my own with it. And for my Benelli, I'll shoot either a modified, or sometimes if I really have to, I'll throw an apple in there.
Yeah. Yeah. These guys all make fun of you because I hunt with a BPS.
No, I like it. Yes. No, it's Clint who makes fun of you.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I bought a BPS, and it's a newer model. Mm-hmm. And it's just so reliable.
Oh, yeah. Now, if you short rack it, though, it'll double feed you.
Yeah, you'll have when you short rack it. But when you use, I mean, that's with any firearm, right? I tell people, you have to, I mean, if you use it as it was intended, operate as it was built to operate, it's not going to fail you.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I would put it up there with the 870 or any of these other.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll be honest, I think they just keep that BPS just outdoes them, because, you know, it's reliable. You can throw anything out of it. You know, it's not going to, you know, fire, and then you have to freaking, you know, rack it hard and stuff like that. It's whatever you put through, it's going to shoot. And yes, it's a heavier gun, but, you know, at least the nice thing is it's not going to rock your world, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you shoot those heavier goose loads and stuff, I mean, you're definitely going to feel it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've shot turkey loads out of that gun, and I mean, with it being so heavy, I mean, it just absorbs it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually surprised that you said the BPS.
Dude, I have a Winchester 1300.
Yep.
And I traded my buddy's dad for a BPS, and I couldn't do it to him because the BPS was way nicer gun. I felt so bad, I guess, next weekend.
You know, the Browning's quote or logo, where is the best there is? There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, shoot. I mean, probably the next gun I get, if I can ever find like a Browning Gold or something like that, I would love to have another Browning.
Yes. Gold. I do like a man. I like a Browning Gold as well.
Yeah.
So I have a handgun shop.
Did we just become best friends?
Friends, yeah. I have a shop that I handed down for my great grandfather, and it's a Browning Belgian Auto, the A5s. Love that gun a lot. I'll still, every now and again, I'll go do like a wood duck hunt with it, and kill a few wood ducks. I don't like taking down in the brackish water.
Right. Very much.
But, you know, in some of these little fresh water cypress reservoirs we have down here, I'll go shoot some wood ducks out of it every year. And just, you know, it's just kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how many guns. No one can tell on those older guns how many thousands of birds they've killed in history.
What's that saying? It's if the trigger's gold, the birds will fold.
Fold, yep.
I mean,
I will say I do. I really do like the May 5.
I can't shoot them. I can't shoot them because it's more of a heads up gun than a bear down gun. You know, because
the humpback.
Yeah, it's like I went and shot skeet yesterday, and I pulled out a little SKB, over and under. And about the third round, the guys I was shooting with were like, Sharp, I hate to tell you this, but you're an automatic shooter, not an over and under shooter. I mean, because like I've been averaging probably 23 about every time I go. Like, you know, I go shoot 3 to 4 rounds. I'm somewhere in between. I'm always like, my lowest is usually 21, and I usually got 24. And yesterday, oof, man, the wheels came off the bus when I pulled out the SKB. I had to go back and get the M2.
Those Benellis, the M2 and the Super Wagyu 2, that sight picture that those two guns have, I mean, you can just acquire anything with it. I mean, and that's the beauty of having two setups. Like, you know, something happens in one gun, you got this one, and you've got the other one for a backup or just for different scenarios. Like, you know, my Benelli's more so my duck gun, or if it's so freaking cold out, I can't use my hands, you know, because when it gets cold out, I mean, there's nothing worse is when your hands are just so numb, you can't rack your pump back. So, I mean, there's pros and cons to everything, you know? So yeah, that's another gun I'd look at getting to is an M2. That is a sweet little gun.
I love it.
Benelli just makes a good auto, but Benelli and Browning are kind of like that. It's like Browning. Benelli, Browning, Benelli. So,
I want to shoot that Synergy over and under that Browning makes, the synthetic one with the camo on it.
What happened to the Satori? That was a beautiful shotgun.
Yes.
Or was it?
No, Synergy. There's a Centauri, but he said he's right about the Synergy. I actually hunted with a guy that John sent me.
I shot both of those. At ducks.
Yeah.
But I like the Synergy. I like the Centauri.
Yeah, Centauri is a good one, but the Synergy makes that Wicked Wing model.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's what it is.
Yeah, it's a Synergy Wicked Wing.
Yeah.
And John sent a guy down here to Louisiana and introduced him to me that I've taken him hunting a couple of times. And that's his gun of choice for me. That's what he does is with that Wicked Wing Synergy. And he seemed to like it. I mean, he's killed birds with it.
Yeah, I want to say it's a newer model, isn't it? Because
yes, it's newer than the Centauri.
Because
there's so many Centauri models, though. Like all the guys I shoot with at the skeet range, a lot of them shoot Centauris.
Yeah, do you ever see how much cost? That's a $2,000 shotgun.
Yeah.
Yeah, base model.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't know this, but these older Brownies, like my BPS, if you look on the receiver, it'll have the serial number. And then if you look closely, it'll tell you what year it was made.
Yeah.
So mine was made in 91. So,
yeah.
And I want to say it's a Japanese, or it was made in Japan. So
yeah, like Mokuru, Japan.
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't know is when, even with these old Brownings, the old A5s,
mm-hmm.
That my grandfather, my great grandfather, my dad hunted with. Once they went to steel, because steel didn't happen in California until 93.
Okay. But
the Japanese barrels, those were all steel rated. So a lot of guys they bought the Japanese barrels and threw them on their Belgian guns so they can keep using them with steel.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing how much history we can get from these things that we shoot waterfowl with, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Even the same with calls.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like, that's what fascinates me with the calls. I mean, some of like, you know, I grew up hunting the old calls and folk calls.
Lohman, and, another one. Yeah.
And then Iverson. My dad always liked Iverson calls.
You know, it's funny. The first duck call I ever blew was a Lohman Sweet Talker. And that is like from it's the late 80s, early 90s. And then the first goose call I ever blew, and my dad actually still has it, was a Lohman's 5000. And I don't know if you find them anymore, but like, I mean, those, like, just like you're saying, it was around that time with the Holtz and all that other stuff. Like Lohman's has been around since like the 30s or the 40s. Yeah. I mean, long time ago. So, but it's crazy how, you know, things have evolved and stuff. But honestly, I still love old school calls. I mean, one of my calls I have for when I go goose hunting is a Tim Grounds Guide's Best, and that was the first goose call he came out with. And that
the old flute.
No, man, if you can blow a flute at some Canada geese, man, you can kill a lot of geese with a flute because it just sounds like that old just lead bird, you know?
Yeah. You ever blow a hybrid?
That deep.
A hybrid? No, I have not.
No. The half gut?
The half breed.
The half breed.
No, I've heard them before on videos and stuff, but no, I've blown the Super Mag, real thing, the G Overhauler. That's a great call too. Yeah. Triple thing. And then the super thing, and then the guide's best. And my lanyard for when I hear like resident geese, it's usually just my real thing, triple thing, and then my guide's best.
Yeah. I watched before Tim passed away, he did like this small documentary.
Yes.
About the half breed.
Yeah, it was with Richie McKnight's video or YouTube channel, Traffic Hunters.
Yep. That was a good 30 minute video. Oh, wow. I didn't know that much history and that much development wouldn't have been to that call.
Oh yeah, I mean that call dated back, you know, years and just
because when you look at it, it's not a flashy looking call, or it's the hunter's call. It's a very there's not much to it.
And you know, the way he designed it, you know, he wanted it to be loud and get their attention. I mean, it was made to hunt traffic geese, and you know, and there's plenty of times, you know, even here in Georgia, you know, we hunt resident geese and stuff where I did not as much as I did anymore, but you know, a lot of times I was not on the X, and you know, and you need, you know, something to get their attention because I mean, you're trying to catch them from going from somewhere else. And I mean, man, if I would have had a call like that, I mean, it would probably be a different story, but that's what it was made for. I mean, just that loud, high pitched, you know, attention getter, you know.
Have y'all ever blown a Alvin Taylor call?
No. Who? Alvin Taylor?
Uh-huh.
Where is he based out of?
I believe he was Arkansas.
No. I should know him, but I...
Clarendon.
Hmm?
Clarendon, Arkansas.
Never heard of him. That's as much as I've been on waterfowl and waterfowl calls, I've never heard of him.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Arkansas, Louisiana area, and even some of like the Maryland area, there's so many call makers because I mean, just
Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee.
Yeah, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, everything around the real foot. Mm-hmm. Because back then there wasn't Bass Pro Shops to go to. There wasn't Max's Prairie Wings or Simmons. So a lot of local guys would just make calls. And
I remember going to Real Foot when we used to hunt at Real Foot and go to the gas stations in the morning to get a biscuit.
Oh, yeah. And
all the gas stations sell duck calls. They all have little hump, like hand turned wood duck calls in every gas station around Sandburg.
Yeah. It's weird about that area is that that's where the metal reed was a big deal. Those metal reeds, the high ball. Real high ball style of calling.
And that's where, like you were talking about the metal reed. At one point, they used to have metal reed contests. Like, you know, you have like, you know, your main street, your meat duck, live duck, you know, all that. At one point in that area, they had metal reed duck calling contests. And I don't know how much you've heard of a metal reed, but it's one of those attention getters. It doesn't sound like a duck, but it's something that, you know, gets their ears from a long ways away. And I used to hunt Real Foot years ago too. And I mean, some of the guys I've hunted with, I mean, they would scream on those things.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous if you've never hunted Real Foot. Like,
and then the Ankin too.
Yeah.
Ankin. Kikin's more down here around the Catahoula area.
They do it out there. Teal, but they start Kikin.
Yeah. And that's because we have a lot of teal. They try to get that high-pitched teal sound.
The biggest walleye of teal I've ever seen was on Real Foot.
Really?
Oh, God. It was crazy. Like, 300-400 birds just buzzing around the lake. It was cool as hell to see.
Biggest one I ever seen was in Arkansas. And funny story, where Shark Guides at, I've hunted in that same area for years. And actually, where did we run into each other? Was it Casey's that one day?
Hayes,
that's right. And I was walking in to grab something and I hear Alex. I'm like, huh? Because I'm like, who else would I know out here? And then I'm like, oh, okay, I remember you. And so that's, you know, we catch up with you since. And every time he's hunting out there, you know, I'd be out there. It's like, hey, you guys kill anything? What are the birds doing? You guys see much? And, you know, because again, we were right down the road from each other, you know, in the Walnut Ridge, Hoxie, Peach Orchard, Delaplane, that area. And, I hunted out there a few times this year, and, it was quite interesting this year. And I'm sure Shark can feel you. I mean, we had some really interesting weather patterns out there this year.
Yeah. Especially that last week.
Yeah. Or week after Christmas, I was actually in Illinois right on New Year's duck hunting with a friend of mine. And I mean, we were busting ice that I swear to God, thick. I mean, it was, I didn't think ice could get that thick. I mean, it was thick with two C's.
Yeah. You could drive a side by side on top of a 6-inch.
Yeah. But you know what's weird this year in Arkansas? Because, you know, all of us, and Chris hunted with me in Arkansas this year over in the Jonesboro area. I've never had that early in the season where I've killed so many spoonbills. And see, they're all spoonbills at that.
See, all right, that's what I was about to get at. It's always been spoonbills, but this year it was a hen spoony beatdown.
The hen spoonbills.
I'm worried about a little bit, like, wrecking on those spoonies, but there are a lot of them.
Dude, let me tell you, I'm here in Louisiana. I can tell you that the spoonbill population is still growing strong.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, you...
We like them Hollywoods.
We call them down here the Lake Charles Mallards.
Lake Charles Mallards, yeah.
And then the teal, I mean, I hunted out there a couple days in November and a couple days in January. I usually don't go out there in December because that's kind of almost like a lull unless the weather gets good. Yeah. And all that first couple days in November, it was just nothing but Hollywoods, teal. I think we killed a few widgeon here and there, a couple specks, a couple snows. I mean, even the mallards, like, I mean, you couldn't even tell them apart. I mean, they didn't, I mean, the only way you can tell it was a drake is it had a yellow bill. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. And then in January,
this year,
I hunted out there the first week after I came back from Illinois. And after that point, I have never seen mallards and pintails in my life. And I mean, it was just constant. Just, I mean, one minute, big bunches of mallards, and all of a sudden it's just nothing but bull sprigs. I mean, it was almost like a duck hunter's heaven. I mean, just nothing but just both. And then a lot of teal. And actually I killed my first canvasback out there in a rice field.
Yeah. I killed mine in a rice field last year.
And,
I mean, Louisiana gets a lot of cans. This year for me down here, I mean, this is probably one of the best years I've ever had in Louisiana since 2017. That's when I moved down here and hunted. But
I hear a train.
Yeah, I live right next to trains.
There's a lot of the podcasts.
We have like extra, like all our podcasts it's a train, it's a fan. It's his window open.
It's a clock. The clock got us.
What's the fan? It was a clock.
The clock got us.
Oh, it was the clock.
Yeah. So
yeah,
I've never killed so many spoonbills and green wing teal. And we kept a little bit of the blue wing teal around.
Yeah.
But spoonbills, green wing teals definitely was on the top of the food chain down here during duck season here in Louisiana.
Dang.
Like Alex said, at the end of the year up there where we were, pintails galore. I got tired of seeing them, man, because you'd actually like, you'd finally, like where we were, I wasn't getting a lot of the mallards. Like you'd see a few mallards, but it was mostly pintails. And when I'd finally get a group of mallards to work, that group of pintails would go cruising across the other side of the field and that mallard would make that spin and just catch up with them and go. That hunt with Stump, Joe. Stump was getting so freaking mad at the pintails because we'd be working these mallards perfect. And like right on that last pass, pintails would kind of come low on the edge of the field and they'd just pick right up.
And yeah.
Right.
And you know what is the one thing I've noticed about hunting in that area, pintails are really skittish, but and Sharp could probably agree with this. Like if you get mallards working and those mallards, like they're going to do it. If there's pintails that are even near them, like, I mean, they'll fall in that. Like you can, you know, throw the duck whistle at them and stuff. I mean, you'll get them to turn maybe a few times, you know, blowing a regular duck call and stuff, but unless something else is working with them, you're going to be hard pressed. I mean, they are so skittish, but every now and then you get those one or two ready to give it up. But most times it's like, in my experience out there, it's always just been with big bunches of mallards. And then every now and then here come the sprigs.
You know what's weird down here? Pintails, if you want to kill pintails in a rice field, spec decoys.
Specs this year on one field, one of the pintails got thick and heavy. The specs pulled in there too. And like, if I had a group of specs working and there were pintails flying in the air,
here they came.
Past those pintails were dropping behind those specs. It was crazy. Like, a lot of times if I saw specs flying, there were pintails working, I just pick up and blow my spec call.
Yeah. Oh, there's one like that where, I mean, you start working the specs and here come the ducks too. And I even pick up my duck call and you just on that spec call. And sure enough, those ducks get, you know, within, you know, gun range or just over the pit and they're loading up to shoot at that point. And I mean, I'm convinced like there's some days out there, if you have spec decoys and snow goose decoys, they're going to finish that more than duck decoys. So as you think about it, they're used to seeing it in every other field around there.
Towards the end of the season, I agree 100%.
Well, look at everything up north with the big, the Canada field, dry field spreads.
Oh yeah.
They'll go even Canada and down here, like up north, they'll put just honker decoys out
and a spinner, and
put a few spinners to kill the mallards in the dry corn.
I mean, like you said, Joe, I think the geese are a confidence decoy to the ducks. You know, I think ducks like geese. Geese hate ducks.
Well, if you think about it, you know, especially out there in northern Arkansas, you walk out to a pit first thing in the morning, I mean, you're going to hear ducks sitting there quacking and peeping or whatever, but geese are going to be there too. So, I mean, it's not like they roost on separate areas, especially if it's a big enough area where, you know, both geese and ducks can get out of there. I feel like, you know, it's a confidence thing, but again, they share the same home, you know what I mean?
Same food, same roost.
Yeah.
They love together.
Because how many times you've been sitting there before shooting light and before the first you hear, you know, snow goose barking and and you hear specs yodeling and you hear a pintail and then gray ducks and then teal. I mean, and you hear just everything, you know.
That white's a duck suck. That's what Dustin said. Mr. Charles told him. Never bust out those snows. You're trying to shoot ducks because it's gonna draw them from every which way.
And that was one of about the December time around here in Louisiana. That was our issue. Mm-hmm. I've never seen so many snow geese.
Oh God, yeah. That was how it was in January when we had a lot of rain out there and everything was flooded. Every pocket, every field that was not flooded, there'd be a snow goose feed over here, there'd be a feed over there, and there'd be a feed over there. And I mean, it was that place was infested with snow geese.
And then I saw a lot this year too, right after that we had that big thaw, the amount of ducks that were feeding in like sheet water. I mean, they're like in almost dry fields. Like you'd go down 63 or like up, what's that, 221 going out of town, I believe, and like on the sides of the highways. I mean, just barely any water. I mean, just a little bit of standing water. And there's birds like they're roosting on actual like completely flooded rice fields, hopping over onto these somewhat dry that sheet water stuff, at least minimal sheet water, and then going back to the deep water fields the roost.
Yeah,
I mean, I saw that a lot, like big feeds this year.
Well, and it was like, you know, people complain, you know, especially it was in November, there was no water out there, and everyone's, you know, getting worried about the rest of the ducks because, I mean, just like anywhere else, no water, no ducks. Well, here comes January, and you almost had to thought about hitting up NOAA for an arc because there's water everywhere, you know, and then now you got too much water. But at the same time, it scatters in both areas, you know, dry, they're only going to go to places with water. When there's a lot of water, they go anywhere.
Yeah, that's the same thing we have down here with the crawfish. You know, in Arkansas, California, those rice fields are probably about anywhere from 6 inches to maybe a foot.
Yeah.
Out here, when you're fishing, when you're doing the crawfishing, it's, you know, average crawfish rice field out here is 24, 30 inches.
Wow.
So, and it's usually me, man. I'm usually the what is the guy version of a Karen? The Kevin?
Chad.
The Chad, or I got to like wrap it up. Cause man, we can keep on going. And we usually, I know we did this when we first started this podcast, and me and Joe had like, what, 3 hour shows. It was crazy. So, we had to find the one to get that breaking point, but man, I definitely want to have more conversations with you.
Yeah.
This has been very like, and especially the transition into like, even like the whole turkey and then the waterfowl and I think everybody has their own like niche and knowledge about what their experience of waterfowl. I get it. We're all chasing birds or whatever, but I mean, I think there's definitely, for me, it's always a learning aspect. So, I guess before we go, I want to ask Sharp and Joe, if y'all have anything before we kind of wrap it up.
No, I appreciate it, Alex. Small world, knowing some of the same people, but I really appreciate being on the show, and hopefully we can be able to do a hunt together soon.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Man, thanks for coming on the show, and
have me, Sharp.
We're definitely hunting together in the spring because your ass is yelping me on turkey next year.
Yeah, just like what Joe said, man, if you're ever in Louisiana, or hell, if you ever come, you're in the Texas area, you know, give me a shout, man. I'd definitely like to take you out. We'll go get some hunting in. So,
we'll do.
But, I guess if there's nothing else, did you want to add anything before we kind of end out, Alex?
Just want to say thank you guys again for this opportunity. Definitely check this one off the list. I'm very honored and very humbled to be a part of y'all's podcast. Like I said, I never thought it'd be a day where about my passion, waterfowl hunting and turkey hunting and stuff like that. So again, this has been a great experience. Honestly, like I've been thinking about this all day at work and just like, oh my God, what am I saying? Am I going to stutter? Am I going to do this? And just take all time and all stuff. Like I said, most of the time you have podcasts, it's like, you know, big names and stuff like that. And, you know, and I was telling Sharpie, so I was like, man, I don't know how much I can, you know, tell you guys, but you know, I'm not really in the calling contest scene anymore. And, you know, I say it's humbling, and I really appreciate it. I'm very humbled, and I'm very honored to be a part of this. I really.
No. And I mean, absolutely, man, we want to thank you. And it's not just about getting the celebrities on here. It's all about getting the real hunters like you yourself that actually is out there grinding and trying to get, you know, not having the benefits of being able to, you know, have a private pond or private, you know, lease or whatever. So, I guess that's it. Again, I want to thank you. And, like always, live valiant and fail.